Indeed, some of my colleagues, I think, would like to rule Purim out of the Jewish calendar. When I came to trying to choose a hymn for us to sing this morning, I recognized that when this hymn book had been put together some quarter of a century ago, not a single good, rousing Purim song had been included. And why? Well, in the first place, the Book of Esther, the history of Purim, though it's included in our Bible, does not contain the name of God. In the second place, when the Megillah, the scroll of Esther, is read, it's not read to a quiet and reverent assembly, to a group of people, parents and children sitting on their edges, the edges of their seats, noisemakers in their hands, eager for Haman's name to be read so that they can twirl the noisemaker and drown it out. Even the staid Talmud prescribes this for Purim. And on this day of the year, a Jew is allowed to drink until he cannot hear the difference between Arur Haman, the phrase "Cursed be Haman," and the phrase "Baruch Mordechai," "Blessed be Mordecai." Now, please don't run out. We have Sunday blue laws in Ohio. Now, of course, you recognize that we too at the temple have gentled Purim down. The Megillah is read during a service. The fun and frolic, the Mardi Gras spirit of Purim has been reduced to a children's hour. This afternoon, time of masquerade and of games. I suppose most moderns don't feel the need for one day a year to be set aside as a permissible time to have that extra drink. But why this difference? Why this instinctive break with tradition? And the reason is not hard to find. The traditional Purim was a catharsis. It was a time in which the community relieved itself of the year-long tension of living under a sword which was hung over their heads. They looked forward to this sociodrama, which was not so much the history of Mordecai and Esther and Haman and Ahasuerus, of Jews and Jew haters in Persia 2,500 years ago, but their own history. But there are very few communities without an enemy, a Haman. There are very few communities that did not have the sense that they were living under an edict of expulsion or living under an edict of death and persecution. And they needed one day of the year to relieve their spirit, to dance, to perform the instinctive rites of sympathetic magic, which would somehow make all turn out well. Their Haman would be dangling on the gallows just as the ancient Haman had been killed, and their lives would be reprieved. Their security would somehow come about. Now, the fact that we have seen fit to change the spirit of Purim simply testifies to the larger ambit of security which we feel in this gracious land of ours. And faced with this new emotional geography, we tend to look to the story of the Megillah for other virtues and other lessons. And the one which it seems to throw out to us most easily, that which is most implicit and important in the text, seems to be a simple lesson about life, about its vicissitude, about its changeable weather. Foolish is the man who assumes that tomorrow must be just like today. Foolish is the man who makes no contingency plans for his life. Here were the Jews of Shushan. One day they were busy, each at his occupation, planning for their daughter's wedding, their child's graduation, bathing the baby and thinking of his future. And the very next moment they find that they are under the sentence of death. And they live under this terrible pall and fear for 6 months. And finally, just as the time of death is approaching, they are suddenly granted a new lease on life. And so it is very often. The most promising career is cut short by illness. We plan for our future, for our child's, our son's future, only to have him receive a letter from the draft board. Where would many of us be if we had not been fortunate enough to be in the right place with the right person at the right time? Like it is not, we are not the masters of our destiny. Luck, chance, fate, call it what you will, plays a major role in our lives. Had we been born in less fortunate times, to a Jewish community which was granted less freedom, into a society which had less abundance, how different our lives would have been. And so, though none of us ought to depend upon good fortune, give up the hard work, the determination, the perseverance, all of us ought to recognize that much of what a man attains, much of what his standing in the community, his wealth, his position, is a matter of chance and good fortune. But there are others who could well be there, but they lack that good fortune. Now we look to the text itself, to the bare bones of the story of the Megillah, for the new meaning. Our ancestors, too, had their moments, their years, their decades of relative security. And during these times when the pressures were not as great, when the fires of fear were not burning as brightly, they, too, looked to Purim for other meanings than that of simple rejoicing and revenge and vengeance against the dreaded enemy. But they looked not to the bare bones of the text, but to its legendary embellishments. And since I promised you this morning to take you on a walk with me on the lighter side, what I'd like to do is to introduce you this morning to the story of Purim as you do not know it, but as our ancestors knew it, as it was told to them in the bazaars of Cairo and Alexandria and Baghdad and Algiers 1,500 years ago. Forget for a moment that we are literalists, that we like to read a text and to read it exactly as it's written. Assume that you're wearing not our Western clothes, but the multicolored cloaks of the Orient. We're now in the bazaar. It's that quiet time around noon hour in the day when the heat is burning down and one leaves off one's work. We're in the coffee house, sipping the heady brew, and we're listening to one of those storytellers, an Oriental troubadour, who begins to tell us something of the embellishment, of the embroidery, of the true history of Purim. And it begins by taking us in our imagination to a place we can never go, to the great, great palace of the emperor. And he speaks to us lovingly of the golden ornaments which surround the palace, of the marble columns, of the whispering fountains, of the cages all in silver in which there are the songbirds. He tells us of the gorgeous costumes of the men and of the women. And as he tells us of these splendors, we have a sense of the distance which separates us ordinary people, we the Jews, from the rich and the powerful. He tells us of Ahasuerus, one of the most powerful of the world's kings, an absolute autocrat, a little man, but big on his high throne, a man who, like so many who have power, seems always to need to prove that he is in fact powerful. He tells us of a wonderful gala, not our Purim, not our carnival, but of a long, drunken brawl, such as the feudal lords and ladies of the ancient Orient sometimes engaged in. And this bacchanalia, it didn't last a few hours of an evening. It was designed to last 180 days and 180 nights. Non-Jews among Jews have had many, many characteristics, and one of them is an amazing capacity for drink. And they told, the storyteller would tell us of this wondrous drinking bout, And he would tell us that the second or the third week of this bacchanalia, the lords who were before Ahasuerus began, as will drunken men, to praise the beauty of their women. My wife, my concubine, is more gorgeous than yours. And the Medes said, there are no women like our Median women. They are tall and lissome and fair of face. And the Chaldean men said, but there are none like our slow-eyed, dark-haired women, none as beautiful, none as exotic. And Ahasuerus listened to the various claims of all the provinces of his kingdom. And finally, being not only a powerful man, but a foolish man, he could not help but boasting of the beauty of the Persian women, his own, boasting especially of the beauty of his wife. And he turned to these lords and he said to them, to prove my point, how gorgeous and attractive and beautiful are our Persian women, I will bring in my own wife, Vashti. There is none more beautiful than she. And you will see with your own eyes that your monarch speaks the truth. Now, dear friends, you know our Talmud, and you know that our Talmud tells us that there are three things which satisfy a man: a beautiful wife, a beautiful home, and beautiful clothes. It's perfectly natural to derive some kind of pleasure from being surrounded with beautiful things. But you also know that our Talmud tells us that a man boasts to his own hurt, that it is foolish to take these feelings which give us pleasure and give them voice, throw them out. Yet Ahasuerus, for all of his power, was such a fool. And when he boasted of the beauty of his wife, he sealed her doom and, in a sense, his. He boasted, and the Lord said to him, I prove to us your boast. And he summoned Vashti from the harem, and he ordered that Vashti be brought before his drinking friends. But Vashti was the daughter of an emperor, and she was the granddaughter of an emperor. She was not a woman to be trifled with. She was not about to be paraded before these drunken louts who were with her husband. And she drew herself up. She refused. But no one can refuse the will of an emperor. Once the will of such a man is challenged, others will challenge it if the challenge passes over unnoticed. And once she had refused, Ahasuerus, who truly loved this woman, had no alternative but to order her immediate execution. And so he did. And he regretted it the moment that he did. And so, my fellow Baghdad merchants, take pleasure in your wife and be proud of her. But at the cocktail hour, restrain your tongue. Vashti dies. The drinking, the revelry no longer pleases Ahasuerus. He feels he must somehow replace this woman of his heart in his home. And so, as you know, he orders a contest, all the women of Persia to be brought before him, and he will choose the one most fitted to be his wife. Now, you friends have lived for years under the illusion that the gorgeous Jewess Esther was the fairest and loveliest of all the women of Persia. And I hate to disturb your romance, but our tradition tells us that Esther was 75 and a grandmother. She was wise. There was a certain grace to her carriage, but she'd never be a Hollywood starlet. She would never have been chosen as the fairest of the women by a man who had not learnt not to boast of beauty, especially the beauty of his wife. Ahasuerus, ridden with guilt, disturbed, pining for his beloved, needed not so much a wife as a mother. And he chose such a one. He chose the Jewess Esther. And you know, my friends, there too is a lesson. For had the Jewess been young, 18, 17, 60, had she been a young, giddy girl who would have been overwhelmed by the privilege of being the mistress of the emperor, the queen consort, Had she been so overawed by the wealth and the power that went with her office, she would have lost her head. And when Mordecai came to her needing her support to free her people, she could not have balanced out her present high position with the danger in which she was placing herself. All of us in this age have a way, do we not, of assuming that salvation lies with the young, that they will save us from our mistakes. And our midrash, I suspect, reminds us that salvation lies even with a 75-year-old grandmother, with age and with wisdom and with an awareness of those teachings and insights which only experience brings. So salvation was wrought for the Jews, not by a young, beautiful demoiselle, but by an elderly matron, by a woman of conviction and of courage. And now let me introduce to you Haman, the evil villain of the piece, black mustache, black cloak and all. There are many kinds of courtiers. There's a certain kind of man who comes of noble family, and he has a sense of the responsibilities of his office. Jewish folklore tended to make a great deal of the old truism that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so Haman cannot be made from one of the noble families of Persia. Rather, he comes from rather ordinary and common stock. In fact, Haman, according to this tradition, is a barber. Now, a barber was among the lowest and most menial of occupations in the ancient world, for he was not simply a man who cut hair. But he was a man who took blood, who had the leeches, who was a poor man's physician. He was not trusted, but he was needed. Haman was such a man, a barber. Haman was an illiterate, born of ordinary stock, when one day, through no fault of his own, he was on a trip and he stumbled across a cave in which great treasure had been kept, and he used this money to buy for himself position and authority. And I can just hear the social conscience of this Oriental troubadour as he drove home to all the merchants who were sitting about him in the coffee house the obvious truth that there's absolutely no correlation between a man's wit and wisdom and his wealth. The chance here, too, plays a major role. Now, why did Haman hate Mordecai? Why did this courtier, this Persian, hate the Jew? It turns out, according to our legend, that when Haman had first found this fortune, he had left it hidden in the cave, and he had raced back to the city in order to find some helpers, some donkeys, some camels to haul out the rich treasure back to his home. And on the way back to the city, he'd been surprised by robbers and taken and held for ransom. Mordecai lived in his birth city, in his home city, and Mordecai had put up the money to ransom Haman. Do you want to know why our tradition tells us that the reward of a good deed is the good deed itself? Because only a fool expects really to be thanked for a favor he has performed. When you owe someone a favor, you're not only grateful, but you have a sense of being inferior to him, responsible to him, and all kinds of ambivalent feelings begin to rage within your breast. So Mordecai did a favor for Haman, and this was his reward. And why did Haman decide that he not only had to erase, do away with Mordecai, but with all the Jews? And here the storyteller would use and select whichever of the explanations of anti-Semitism fit the events of his day. Perhaps it was that the lord of this city was greedy and was trying to milk the Jewish community of extra taxes in order to feather his own nest. And so he would talk of Haman's greed. Perhaps he was simply an overly fanatic religionist who felt that he somehow proved his faith in his God by abusing those who worshipped another God. Whatever the reason, and the reasons have been many, The storyteller would somehow weave the story of Haman and Mordecai around so it was to the point, existential, relevant. And here we leave the dramatis personae of the Purim story. They act and they interact in ways wondrous to behold. The legends are all available. They can be read and enjoyed. Each of those tales bears its own little pithy truth. But I would close simply with this vignette. It's known in our tradition as the dream of Mordecai. It seems that when Mordecai was sitting at the gate of the king Ahasuerus, he had a dream which warned him of the danger and also promised him relief. And in this dream, he saw two dragons coming far away across a long, low, level plain. The dragons, as is the wont of dragons, were spitting fire. And when they put down their foot on the earth, the whole earth shook. And there was, some miles in front of them, one little, lonely figure, without a weapon in his hands, a Jew. And as these awesome, fearful figures approached, this little figure simply stood still, paralyzed almost with fear. And then suddenly in their dream, a spring of water rose at the feet of this solitary Jew and began to flood the plain. And the water spewed out of the earth, and the plain became mud. And little by little, the dinosaur's steps were stuck in the mud, and they could no longer run. They began simply to move slowly, slowly forward, and finally, they could move no longer. And so, according to the legend, the dinosaur Haman, the dinosaur Ahasuerus, power, the authority of the world without, was somehow kept from the Jew by this flood of water. Now, it seems a childish, stupid little story, this. But in its own way, it reveals and personifies one of the great phrases of the Bible. According to the prophet, justice shall spring like water, and righteousness like a mighty stream. And somehow the truth is it not, that when there is justice in the land and righteousness and decency between people, then the Jew need not be afraid. The dragons of hate and fear are not abroad. Then truly, there is security for all. And so we come back across the ages, from Baghdad to Cleveland. We shed our colorful robes for our ordinary dress. We've enjoyed this little visit. There have been a variety of teachings and of ideas thrown up at us. And we return to the text of Purim as we know it, and the context of Purim as it relates to our lives. What is it, basically? It's a story of the Jewish people. And what is it that saves the Jews of Shushan? A woman, a queen, one who was willing to throw in her lot with her people, who, though she is secure and anonymous in the palace, in the moment of crisis is willing to shed her anonymity, to appear before the emperor, and to say, I am a Jewess. I am one of the accused. I am one of the convicted. If you kill them, you must kill me. Now, the security of Israel today, security of any Jewish community, depends on what? On our willingness to share its heartaches and its responsibilities, to cast in our lot with its destiny, to share our wealth, our privilege, and our position for its benefit. Amen.